This episode was great for me personally because I've done an episode with my father before, giggling with my dad. My dad has a great sense of humor. He has a really fruity shtick. He can do stuff like
Well,
this.
one very wintry night, I went to Burn Dairy to get milk and half and half, and these two older ladies were there, and it was snowing and cold and blowing, and one turned to the other and said, "Agnes, I bet we get 9 inches tonight." And I said, "Don't you wish?"
And I find that funny, but sometimes I get to just reconnect with him, like the real him. And he's brilliant. He has his PhD from Northwestern. He went to Oxford. And his dad was a furnace cleaner, just a Chicago kid who was really smart and worked hard. And his passion is rhetoric, conflict management, public speech. He loves how people think and feel. And when I see his eyes light up, like he really cares about something, it reminds me of me and him when I was a kid and just some really good times. And we can go years without really connecting on this level that I can see him passionate about stuff, And so it was great. And this episode, my dad kind of teaches me how to reconnect with the side of myself that isn't jaded, I guess. Being a comedian can get you punch drunk. So let's open up with something optimistic, how I was as a kid.
Can I tell a very lovely Owen
Of
story
course.
from when you were about 12 years old?
Yes.
I had real difficulty with the dean we had out here, and I did not want to bring these problems at home, and I really tried not to, and I don't know whether I did or not, but you got our bicycles out, and you were maybe 12 at the most, and you said, "Follow me." So I'm on my bicycle following you. I'm thinking to myself, where the hell is he going to take me? And you took me to the middle school. We went to the middle school woods where there was that lovely park bench right by the pond. You came by. We stopped there. You said, "Dad, sit here. I'll be back in about 20 minutes. You need this." And I was there all by myself thinking, what a grand thing to do.
Thanks,
And I
Dad.
know I thanked you before, but let me do that again. That was a wonderful way of handling interpersonal conflict.
Yeah, I'm trying to get you out to LA now. I'll put you on a beach and do the same thing. Yeah, my parents used to call me their little Buddha because I didn't talk much. I just played the piano all the time. I said I could talk to plants. I felt like plants could talk to me. A very peaceful kid with a lot of inner peace. And I lose that a lot because I think my job, which is more than a job, it's a passion. I love comedy, but it can develop some bad habits. So I kind of opened up to my dad about basically how do I not be an asshole? Because my job rewards such psychotic reactions. I mean, they're very truthful and very honest, and I think people pay money to reconnect with that reptilian part of their brain. I'll give you a few examples. All right, here's me with a girl. Here is me with a Southern hillbilly.
It is like the South. Okay. I think that the country isn't divided north and south. It's rural and urban. And I think that when you're from a small town and like 6 hours north of the city near Canada, you relate more to the South because it's agricultural based. Roosters and shit. And I think that that is more southern than it is New York. Now it's time for your point. Good, thank you. Takes a big man to agree that a fucking alpha just took him over.
Here's me with an all-black crowd in Cleveland.
How old are you when you met her? You said 30s, dickhead. That's a range of 10, you fucking moron. Do the math. I think I've done it with a letter, S. Numbers don't end in letters. You do the math. Alright, here we go. If you come to the king, you better kill the king. That's all I'm fucking saying.
Yeah, I'm rewarded for being psychotic. So I thought I'd reconnect with the professor, you know, have him just teach me shit, because he's taught me a lot. Conflict management. This is him explaining what it is that he's into.
I thought it was really interesting that a lot of people call it conflict resolution, and you call it conflict management. Why is that?
Yes, well, my course is one of the very few ones that's called conflict management rather than resolution. And it's based on the belief that there are many conflicts that are not resolvable, but they should be able to be managed. That is, people will still have their differences, still may hate each other. That's fine. But they will not resort to violence against
right.
each other.
I love that you think that way, because being raised by two college professors, I always saw that professors a lot of times have really good ideas if it was possible to put into place, but they don't admit to human nature, if that makes sense.
Yes.
You know, like the Woodrow Wilsons of the world will say, well, everyone should just stop this and stop that. And that's equivalent to saying we should get rid of gravity, because human nature is based around acquiring goods and stuff through war.
Yeah.
So I like that you admit that some conflicts are never, there's certain conflicts that will never stop.
Right.
And so managing that is all we can really do.
And as naive as it sounds, the founding of the United Nations was a very rational way of saying this is how we can do that. Now, it was based on the assumption that wars are based on rationality, which they aren't.
Right.
That somehow country A has a legitimate grievance with country B, so let's all go to the UN and talk it to death until we're no longer going to be violent. Well, that's a nice model, and in some places it has really worked.
Right.
But in some of the big issues, World War II and so on, it simply isn't.
That's working. What I love about my dad is he's a diehard Democrat. He used to tell me there was Republicans under my bed. Like, that was my spooky story. Like, the Republicans would get me. And Democrats can be super annoying, just like Republicans can be super annoying. It's kind of like I like socially liberal Republicans, and I like realistic Democrats. Because Republicans are, you know, fire and brimstone to gay people and marijuana will kill you. That whole Ronald Reagan bullshit. They're just insanely annoying people. But a socially liberal Republican is very tolerable. And that's how I feel about Democrats, like a realistic Democrat. Because I always would make fun of my dad that Democrats are the first to stand up for a cause and then the first to sit down. I'm not political myself, but I love politics in the sense that I like seeing how it all fits together. Phatic communication is so important. And a lot of this podcast is about phatic communication. And here's one of the stories that he told me to illustrate what this is and how important it is. And it's between Menachem Begin of Israel and Anwar Sadat from Egypt. This is in the late 70s, I believe. And they're having a peace accord, and just listen to my pops.
They sat at the table for about a week at Camp David with President Carter. Nothing worked. They didn't like each other. They had packed their bags to leave, right, with no accord of any kind. And then Carter talked them into having kind of a social hour, kind of, I don't know if it was a cocktail hour or not, but simply a social hour where we're not going to talk about the issues we're confronting. So at that time, both Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin had pictures of their grandchildren. So phatic communication is the communication of small talk. Hi, how are you? Fine, I'm fine. How's the weather? Doesn't rain enough. Have a good day. But what they did was looked at pictures of their grandchildren, and finally one of them, I think it was Begin, I'm not sure, one of them said, why don't we try to make the world a little better for them? Wow. And so that was the opening to finding a peace accord. Now, Anwar Sadat knew he'd pay the price. And about a year and a half later, he was assassinated by an Egyptian at a sporting event. And he probably in his heart of hearts knew that that would happen. But at the same time, how do we make the world safer for our grandchildren was the opening to an enormous peace agreement that has still held.
That's some powerful stuff. Sadat was killed, and he probably knew he was going to be killed. And Martin Luther King Jr. had a similar vibe in that the dream was bigger than him. And that's one of the problems with leaders. I think that the ego that gets you there is the ego that drags you down. And that's why I'm very supportive of women in leadership, and I hope to see more of them, because I think that testosterone can be a real bitch. You know, it's a very territorial thing. Like I had my piano teacher when I was 11, became a man. She was a woman and then became a man. And I do a bit about it. It was on Halloween, so I made the transition easier. But Halloween never ended. And I'm friends with him now. I was obviously close with her then. And I saw both sides. Brilliant person. Absolutely brilliant. You can see what hormones do. Like, you can see that hormones are a drug. Like, hormones make... Like, testosterone makes you territorial. It makes you say, I'm going to win. I. It's almost like Adderall versus weed. And women are more like weed, and men are more like Adderall. Like Adderall and cocaine, you start every sentence with I got a business plan. I say we fly to the fucking moon. And weed is more just like communal. And I think estrogen has that red wine effect of just like, it's not about us. It's about our grandkids. It's more of a... more female. And I think that long term, that works really, really well. We'll get to feminism more in this podcast. Things get pretty interesting and dicey. Okay. Oh, here's actually a clip that's interesting. Sometimes I think that people label sexism in places where it isn't. Listen to my pops. Check this out.
A lot of research was done on women in organizations and the notion that women would still feel a certain level of covert frustration because they'd be a part of a working group. They knew what problems and issues there were. They were part of the team to do this. And then all of a sudden, the solutions just emerged and they had nothing to do with it. It occurred to them that the men would play golf on a weekend.
Yeah.
And through phatic communication, hi, how are you? Boy, look at that golf swing. How's your putter? Do you have a birdie? All these kinds of things. They would talk about business. And when it was all over, they had settled a lot of issues on the golf course that nobody knew anything about.
When the boys get together, we always ask each other how the putters are. How's your putter, big guy? I think so many problems are resolved when you're doing something else, where it's just when you're just hanging out and you're not focusing on the problem. It's the same in relationships. Like, if someone needs space, give it to them. Because if it's like, why do you need to fuck so much? Or why aren't we fucking? Or why are we doing this? Or why can't you, you know, clean the floor? Or why? If you're always focusing on the problem, it just is a battle. It's always going to be that battle. But if you just do something else, like let's, you know, play Scrabble, or let's watch HGTV and yell at that, or let's, you know, if you get an outside factor and you can just be yourself again and let down your sword and shield, you can get a lot more done. And I think that there's collateral sexism. I think that story is a major advantage for men. It always has been the boys club type thing. And it's like a male activity where they give each other an advantage isn't sexism. That's just, it's collateral sexism. It's kind of like when a bomb goes off and innocent people get killed, that it wasn't intended. It wasn't gross negligence. It's negligence. Sexism is women aren't allowed to play golf. That's sexism. That's saying because of your gender, you can't hang with us. But, you know, if you're part of someone's church or synagogue or mosque and you hang with them every weekend or on holidays, there's a good chance that you'll do business with them just because you know them and you see them interact as people and you're part of a tribe. We're tribal. And I don't think it has to do with penises and vaginas as much as people think, and it more has to do with interests. So there is sexism in this world, but there's also a lot of misplaced rage towards stuff like that. And it's so has to do with communication. Here is a great story. I love this story because we're talking about politics. We're talking about Barack Obama, and there seemed to be this divide in his presidency where it was like him against everyone. Like people were like, whatever he says, we're not doing. And so many people jumped to the race card. Oh, it's racist. And my dad told me a really cool story. And by the way, as I said, he's a diehard Democrat. So he's not trying at all to discredit Obama. He thinks that Obama has pretty bad fat at communications. So check
sure,
this out.
That Obama apparently in November, in late November, early December 2008, after he'd won the White House, there was a meeting of all the political leaders of the House and the Senate and the executive branch at Camp David. There were maybe 30 people in the room talking about their agendas. And it was, understand, it went very lovely for a good deal of the day until other people whose agendas were very different from Obama's. And I understand it was Congressman Ryan from Wisconsin who said, well, here's my agenda. Why aren't we going to work on that? And Obama smiled at him and said, remember, I'm the president. I won. Which shut down any kind of rational discussion of the merits of whatever the argument was.
Yeah.
And that set him on this negative decline for the rest of his presidency.
Because that's an emotional, when someone says something like that, you're now exiting the rational and becoming emotional.
Yes.
They treat Obama like an outsider, like he's not allowed in this house, blah, blah. Yeah. He was a first term senator. First. No one knew who the fuck he was. And you want to know what else? He connected with young people. That's scary. I'm 35 and I feel it. I don't understand Snapchat. Obama's taking selfies with people. And then you have these old, like decrepit, like just men that know nothing. You know, they think that if a woman wears pants, they're a lesbian. I mean, that's how old these fucking guys are. And then you got Obama is on YouTube. They don't know what the hell YouTube is. Scares the hell out of them. And this is one of my favorite parts of the whole conversation is position versus interest. That, just check this out.
Sure, had a couple where the girlfriend said, well, you're going to go home with me to Rochester to see my parents for Thanksgiving dinner. If not, I think we should consider breaking up. And he said, I can't go there then. So they had this big argument. They came to me. We had a nice mediation, conversation, and so on. I said, why do you want to do this? And she said, well, I want my parents to meet Ralph. I said, well, can they meet him on Friday? Can he come over on the weekend? I tell you what, since he lives on Long Island, why don't you invite him to your house for Sunday? He'll drive up Sunday, spend the afternoon with your family, and drive the two of you back to Oswego, where you can visit, right? So then they were both happy, realizing that my position is we have to be on such and such a date. You have to meet my mom and dad versus saying, well, that's your position. But what is your interest? My interest is I want them to meet. Well, if that's your interest, we can find some other way to do that.
What someone wants is their interest. This is what I want. But the position they take can be against their interest. Emotional. You know, people get emotional when they feel attacked or they feel triggered or they feel that they're losing ground or something. They will take a position that does not coincide with their interest. Kind of like that story my dad said where it's like this girl wanted her boyfriend to meet her parents. Thanksgiving didn't matter, but it became about Thanksgiving. And then it became about, and then the fighting escalated until there was nowhere to go. I saw that a lot with the Confederate flag thing. I mean, the Confederate flag became more about the South feeling like the Confederate flag clearly shouldn't be on a state building. I don't think the South would even really argue that if they're in the cold light of day. I don't think that anyone really, I mean, some people, there's a percentage of the population that probably misses the good old days when people were farm equipment, but they're a tiny group and they're dying and they're old and they are sick and weak. I think a lot of people that were like, fuck you, I'm keeping my flag. I think it was phatic. I think it was about feeling attacked. I think it was about feeling talked down to by people, that they're like these ignorant rednecks. How can they be so stupid? And they're like, we have a proud heritage. And then their position became, don't tell me that I'm dumb. Don't tell me what I can and can't do. And at that point, their interest had nothing to do with a flag that represents slavery. It has to do with not being told they're dumb. This brings me to a point that this conversation happened several weeks ago, and I've turned part of this into a joke. Donald Trump is the quintessential position interest guy. No one wants him president. No one. No one's interest goes with that mop-headed, just monopoly piece of a fucking moron. But people's positions get aligned with him. I find that happening with myself sometimes. I'm a comedian. I hate politically correct people. They bother the fuck out of me. Don't say that. Don't say that. I mean, there was a point when someone was like, Donald Trump said women are fat bitches. And he was like, yeah, Rosie O'Donnell's a fat bitch. And he just like said it. And everyone was like, but you just, and he's like, yeah, no, she is. She's fat and she's a bitch. And that lit my eyes. You know, I felt that spark that I think a lot of people feel for him, where it's like, yes, but other than that, he's terrible. And I'll show you right now with live audio my point. This is from Jacksonville, Florida. I loved it. I had a blast this weekend. I love those crowds. They're awesome. But Jacksonville, Florida is basically southern Georgia. It is the South. They love Trump. They're Republican. They're right wing as fuck. And watch me just start ripping.
It's like presidents have to just like not do anything. That's the whole point. They have to be like Applebee's managers. Like, you guys like the soup? No, it sucks. Hope, change. Like you can't, people are like, Trump says it how it is. It's like, yeah, bad. You can't say how it is. Imagine if you're a manager at Applebee's. Yeah, we don't like the soup. Really, I'm Donald Trump. I'll piss in your mother's cut mouth. It's like, you're getting a very bad Yelp review. I'll buy Yelp. Piss in your grave, cunt. That's Trump. Do we want that at the fucking UN?
I mean, it surprised me. I thought I was going to eat shit on that. I thought I was going out on a limb. It's because I didn't go in to that thought by being like, you guys are stupid. How could you possibly like him? You're dumb. I went in being like, no, obviously he's funny. Like I like him in a sense. Like he says shit that makes me laugh. But how he couldn't even be an Applebee's manager. And they were like laughing. They're like, yeah, totally. Like even people that are for him, they're more against not him. I mean, atheists are like that a lot. Sometimes I almost want to be more religious just because I hate atheists. Like when you see Bill Maher and his smug, stupid face, like talking to an old woman being like, there is no God. There's, you know, he almost gets off on telling people there's no God. And when they die, the lights go out. You know, someone that isn't, I'm not talking about people that are burning crosses and exterminating villages. I'm talking about people that have just lost their husband. They're 75. They hope they see him in an afterlife. Someone who just wants to kind of, and it's like, no, that's the opiate that holds on to the, it's like, shut the fuck up. Like, fuck you. No one knows. I interviewed a Nobel Prize winner in physics last week. Some of my best friends are Caltech PhDs in physics. No one fucking knows. Is it a white man in the sky that says not to eat shellfish? Of course not. But no one knows. How does Bill Maher know? Einstein didn't know. No one knows how many universes there are. No one knows if it's fractal, infinite multiverses. No one knows if it's like membranes that bump each other, causing an infinite amount of big bangs. 96% of the universe is unknown. and this piece of shit can say that he knows. And there's so many atheists like that. Agnostics are fine. You know, I doubt that. That's where I am. I doubt there's a God, but maybe. How the hell am I supposed to know? I'm a monkey with a software update that hasn't happened in 50,000 years. I still think I'm being chased by demons sometimes. I have dreams of spiders. I'm so flawed, it's laughable. If I was a computer, I'm using AOL. I'm still on Netscape. How the hell am I supposed to comprehend a God? But these atheists are like, oh, I know there isn't one, and you're dumb if you think it. You can be anti-ideology. You can be anti-like, but not really, because anti-ideology is a fucking ideology. God, Bill Maher's a fucking dumbass. And there's really no heroes anymore, ever since the invention of Google. No one can be put on a pedestal. I don't know if that's good or bad. Basically, the president's job is just not to be hated that much. Here's another little tidbit about Obama. This is a quote that I thought was really interesting.
Obama's first year, when everybody said, well, let's look at the first 100 days and compare them to Franklin Roosevelt and all this. Now, Robert Reich knew Obama. He knew Clinton very well. They were both Rhodes Scholars together in England years ago, and Clinton appointed him Secretary of Labor. He's now Distinguished Professor of Public Administration at Berkeley. And so he was asked about this, and he said, don't compare Obama to Roosevelt. Barack Obama could not desert the upper class, because that's the class he wants to belong to. On the other hand, he will not have the common touch of Harry Truman to working class people because of his arrogance. Now, yeah. I've never met either of the Obamas, so I don't know. But a prominent Democrat says he both wants to become a member of the 1% and he's arrogant.
In the end of the day, people open and close doors. Your doorman is more powerful than a lot of CEOs, because they let you in and out of your building. You can get on and off, and you can get a free ticket if you just talk properly to someone on a customer service line. All doors are operated by people. Until artificial intelligence take over the world, we're all just people. And arrogance, you know, makes people turn on you. You're the sick monkey that should be kicked out of the village. Oh, this is pretty funny. So I say something that sounds very controversial, but I can back it up. And listen to my mom in the background gasp at what I say. My mom, bear in mind, is also a professor, very intelligent, very strong woman, unbelievable. I'm going to do I interviewed her too. I'm going to do a whole podcast about her. It's going to be called Cultural Plasticity. She's so into neuroplasticity right now. But just listen to her in the background.
I've always thought
gasp.
That about comedy, when people are like, women are just as funny as men. It's like, no. And it's not because they're women. This is...
All right, I'm going to play the full clip and then we're going to discuss. My mom ended up agreeing with what I was saying.
How do I say this without sounding insane? It's fucking true, though, and I'm just sick of people saying, okay, there are women that are as funny as men, if not funnier than men. Mm-hmm. It's very possible. It's a fact. But it's about necessity. So a woman can be very attractive and not speak. Mm-hmm. A man... You know, for those of us that aren't Brad Pitt, which is the vast majority of men, we just fall into the shadows very easily unless we become either really rich or really fucking funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll stand behind that point. And there's female comedians that can smoke me on stage. Fact, obviously. Women can be as funny as men. They should be funnier. There's another clip I'll play where my dad actually thinks that women should be funnier. It's just necessity. because women can make life and they're just better looking and more desired, they already have that much of an advantage that they don't need comedy. Comedy's for just troll donkeys like us. Most women that I know that are funny, I mean, some of them are just naturally funny. My girl's crazy funny, smart, engineer. You know, I've always been attracted to funny and smart. But a lot of dudes aren't. It's not even a plus, but it's a necessity. It's like, do you have to be funny? Dudes kind of do, because they have to peacock in a sense. They have to be like, I can help us get through problems. We can laugh through problems. That's why women find humor attractive, because it shows intelligence. Like, because you can put ideas together, like with your fast brain processor. And it also is like, when we have hard times, we can laugh through it. You know, humor will elevate your status, your social status. It'll give you wealth. It'll give you stability. It's very attractive in a man. I find it attractive in a woman, but culturally, let's just be honest, it isn't. It's like a lot of my female comedian friends that crush, like sometimes will be like, yeah, it doesn't like get me dick. Like, okay, here's a bit I wrote about necessity. This is about, because sometimes, sometimes people will say, oh, Americans, you're ignorant because you don't speak more languages. That's like saying, oh, women aren't funny. Why aren't women funny? This is why.
All my European friends are like, stupid American, you only know one language. I'm like, yeah, because we don't have to learn anymore, because we're American. We can drive 3,000 miles and speak the same language. That's called good fucking planning. We're like, English, wrap it up. Yeah, let's go back to high-fiving and fucking. And that's good.
Yeah, and the funnier women are that I know, the more they'd agree with that. They'd be like, yeah, it's great. I'm funny as fuck. There's like a female renaissance right now. And I think all of this is changing right now, by the way. This is one of the craziest times to be alive, because we're experiencing a social renaissance that puts the former renaissance to shame. Right now, everything's changing. And you can see it, like Ronda Rousey, the fighter. Like, attractive, everyone loves her. It's like, everyone's like, yeah, you can see that it's changing. People are like, fine with the president being a woman. They're fine with any job being a woman. It's exciting. I just hope that it goes properly. It doesn't get all, you know, spitey and hateful and shitty. Because I think that's the problem with a lot of feminism, is I think that feminism is... What I consider destructive feminism is when you're considered a strong woman when you oppose men. The strongest women I know some rock star fucking alpha females. Alpha, alpha, alpha. Like, literally would tell me to sit. Like, and I'm a pretty alpha dude. Like, I'm talking about powerhouses. They don't oppose, they're not against men. They love men. They're like, yeah, men are great. Like, yeah, you guys are awesome. You can get that shit off the shelf. It's the same with like acting like men. It's like you can just be, I think what feminism should be is whatever you are. If you want to bang 1,000 dudes, do it. You want to chew tobacco and drive a NASCAR, go for it. If that's who you are. If that's not who you are and you're trying to be male to be strong, you're going to end up broken. If you want to be a princess in a tower, fine. Feminism is whatever you are is okay. That's what feminism is. Feminism isn't fighting and winning at male shit. Unless that's you. Unless you, Ronda Rousey would beat the fucking shit out of me. She would beat me to death. She would make me cry. I mean, there's so many examples of that. You know, Sarah Tiana, Amy Schumer, Whitney Cummings, all these women are just rock stars. And also pro male. I mean, none of those women are like, they're all very just communal, awesome. They have the best of both worlds. I don't know. I think it's a great time to be alive. All right. What's up? I just wanted a crazy rant. Here is my dad's take on why women should be funnier.
And objectively speaking, if you look at the look at the rhetorical components of the kind of language of men and women, you would think that women would have an edge in comedy. Let me tell you why. Because I've taught public speaking classes for years, and we teach speeches of demonstration, speaking to inform, speaking to persuade. We don't teach speeches to entertain. Why? Because it's dependent upon having a sense of humor, and secondly, it's content-less discourse. Now, I can persuade you that you should vote for Donald Trump. Here's my thesis. Here's my evidence. Here's how it holds all together. Here, you know, and it's objective to myself. But comedy isn't like that. So you would think, since women are more socialized to be concerned about relationships, to be concerned about themselves, to be concerned not just about the objectification of things, would be better at it. There was a feminist, I can't think of her name now, who thought most of persuasion and most of rhetoric was actually very much a male-dominated, patriarchal, bad activity, because you were in the rhetorical arena to change somebody's idea, to change somebody's perception, to give them information that they didn't and perhaps didn't even want to have. And so where is the rhetoric of understanding, of love, of caring?
So true.
That isn't out there. And so Gerhardt was her name. So she thought most of rhetoric, and I lecture about some of these things from time to time, is male, patriarchal, and bad for a culture.
Okay, I mean, because there's tons of shit against men. I mean, if men were as touchy as women in a lot of subjects, there would just be no end to just constant bitching. Here's a bit I do.
I'll give you an example of sexism against men that we don't care. Women can say deeper during sex. You ever think about that? You're like, oh, you like that? Your girl's like, deeper. You're like that? Like that? She's like, deeper. You're like that? She's deeper. It's like, ladies, you think we're holding out on you? The fact women say deeper means they think it's an option. Like, if you got some dick, we're keeping it in the bank. Women think there's a chance for, like, no, baby, you don't get that bass hitch. That's mine. One day you will. But not yet. I'm not ready. I worked hard for that bass hitch. Drank a lot of milk. How would you feel if we said tighter? It's the same exact thing. It's identical. We'd end up dead on snap. But you don't say tighter. Your man's just like, tighter. It's like, I'm trying. It's like, no, do something different. It'd be insane. By the way, ladies, we're going as deep as we can. From our first pump to our dying pump. We got no more dick. And I want that on my fucking tombstone.
I stand behind hormones. I think that testosterone is anabolic steroids. The more you take, the more you want to fucking put your head through a wall. And the more estrogen you take, the bigger your breasts get, the more you want to cry. So just bear that in mind. I think we should all work together a little more.
Lawyers are lousy mediators. They're never any good at it because they're partisan, because a lawyer has a client. Mediators don't have clients. As a mediator, I'm in control of the process of what goes on. I'm not in control with what the outcome is going to be.
That's having a horse, that's the old expression, I don't have a horse in the race.
Right.
And that's why money in politics fucks everything up. That's why private-owned jails fucks everything up. That's why cops and their statistics fucks everything up. Because you don't want a pony in the race. You don't want your cop wanting you to be arrested. You don't want a politician working for whoever pays them money. They're supposed to work for the people. You don't want lawyers in some of these processes, because a lawyer has a client. There's a winner and there's a loser. And a lot of this shit, there is no winner and there's no loser. That's why I consider myself a type of feminist. I'm not one of these pussy feminists. It's like, women have it so hard, they need to... No, I'm a feminist in the sense that, like, I think testosterone can cloud judgment. I think testosterone and jizz building in the balls can make people think that they have to always win. And that's goes back to the very beginning of this podcast where I asked my dad for help. It's like, I'm a emotional cage fighter. Like I have to say, I literally will tell people like the craziest shit to keep dominance over crowds. And I mean, I used to work at a Renaissance fair where people threw fucking tomatoes at my face. And I said that I was going to fuck their wives. Like I know testosterone. I know wind. I'm very, very, very competitive. And as Gandhi said, an eye for an eye until the world is blind. And even Gandhi beat his wife. And why do I know that? Because of Google. Google ruined heroes. I asked my dad for advice. Check this out.
One, I think we have a vast amount of insecurities. I think it's almost bred into the culture. Helicopter parents, you're in first grade, second grade, third grade, you've got ballet lessons, you've got piano, you've got lacrosse, oh, you're going to go to football, then from now we have this and this and this and this. So can everybody be good at everything? For 7 summers, I taught at Princeton, and I would meet these students who would say, oh, I'm so glad I'm not working for the poor anymore, and I'm not a volunteer for the Red Cross, I'm not building somebody else's house. I said, why? She said, I had to do that to get here. That had to be part of my resume. I had a perfect score on the SAT. I had an average of 100 in high school. Not good enough. What else have you done? And right. So I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore. But then what happens to those people? Right? So in a sense, there's all kinds of conflict or kinds of conflagration because one of our own insecurities. Secondly, what I think, and this is a guess because I don't really research this, I think part of it is the fact that a lot of younger people realize that you're not going to have it all. Having it all isn't there anymore. We don't have the air and the water and the resources we had 20, 30, 40 years ago. You will not have a $400,000 house with a 5-car garage and a trophy wife and all that. Those things, the average college graduate this year will have 5 to 7 unrelated jobs or careers by the time she or he retires, 3 of which aren't even invented yet.
Wow.
So the first job you get at Merrill Lynch or someplace, remember, 5, 7, 10 years, that job won't be here.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, all the girls, all the women who weren't going to go to college, they wanted to be, quote, key punch operators. You could take a 1-semester course and learn how to do that. And you sat in front of a computer and you key punched in for electric bills, gas bills, your Sears Roebuck bill. You type in 1773258 and that card would come out with all those dots, put it in an envelope and away it went. Those jobs are gone. There's nothing like that anymore. Nobody does that.
Yeah.
The whole technology is different. So here you are being very, very good at something, right? One could say in 1910, I was the best buggy whip maker in Oswego. Well, by 1915, honey, you don't have a job.
And isn't that what makes people deserve the greatness is adaptation?
Yes, exactly. Because there are some people who are very, very good at that and some people who are not.
Adapt. Your breath is a gift. Just being alive is a gift. You deserve nothing. So just try to adapt. Just try and make yourself happy. Try and learn from women in the sense that relationships matter. Relationships with everyone. The best men, the most alpha men have female traits, and the most alpha females have male traits. It's almost like the perfect human is both. And until that happens, until somehow that's fused, we just have to work with each other, especially with communication. If you can be a dominant communicator and a passive communicator, you're king or queen. Because that's another thing working against women. They don't argue on their own behalf. Adam Grant wrote a book called Give and Take. And that was one of his points. He's a professor at Wharton, the youngest full professor in the history of Wharton Business School, which is the best business school debatably in the world. And they've done studies where women are much less likely to argue about their wage, negotiate. They don't negotiate. Like if someone's like, you're making $38,000 a year, they're like, all right, dudes are way more likely to be like, I want 45, because women are more focused on relationship versus product. Women are better advocates for others. They'll negotiate for someone else better than a man will. Like they'll be like, no, my son or my husband or my client or my talent, you know, if someone's an agent, needs more. Like they're vicious when it comes to getting things for others. But when it comes to themselves, that's why I think Tina Fey wrote the book Bossy Pants, entitled it Bossy Pants. It's kind of like a fuck you to that, where it's like, you feel there's this like shame. There's this shame of sounding bossy if a woman were to be like, I deserve more. And then when they bottle that up, that's when they can sound real cunty. Okay, this is how we're going to close down shop. My dad and I were talking about being time rich versus money rich. And I was raised very little cash. I think my parents' combined income from my childhood was like 12 grand a year. I used to collect cans and shit as a paper boy. Never had new clothing until I finished growing. You know, no TV as a kid. We didn't get Christmas presents. We got a calendar. We used to celebrate father time and baby new year. but they were so time rich and so emotionally rich that they loved the fuck out of my brother and I. And they gave us everything we could ever wanted that wasn't made of carbon. This has been a pretty personal podcast. It was touching for me because I don't always get to talk to my dad that way. And I love him so much and I'm so proud of him. And I'm trying to be a better person. I'm trying not to react to things and trying to be more in control. Because there's no winner in the end of the day when you fight over dumb shit. Interpersonal is important. External, just let it go, you know? Yeah, write me what you think. I'd love to hear from you guys. Why didn't they laugh podcast at gmail.com. Subscribe, comment, rate, spread it around. If you think I'm a piece of shit and you disagree with me, let me know. If you agree with me and you think I'm awesome, let me know. Either way, I want to engage. I want to learn from you. I am on tour a ton right now. This is coming out Friday. So Saturday I'm at Mill Valley Throckmorton Theater. It's amazing. It's right outside of San Francisco. Check owenbenjamin.com/tour. Get tickets. Weekend after, Madison, Wisconsin. I am on Comedy on State, one of the best comedy clubs in the entire country, hands down. Madison, Wisconsin is the birthplace of The Onion. It's the home state of my mother. It is fucking great. Weekend after, Ontario, California, the Cholos. I'm down, going to have some wicked Hispanic crowds, which I love because they don't laugh with ha-ha. They say ja-ja, Orange County. It's going to be phenomenal. Then I have Pittsburgh Improv first week of October, and then I'm on a one-nighter rock venue tour throughout October. We're doing Vienna, Virginia. I'm doing Brooklyn. Why am I saying we? It's me. I'm so used to touring with the Sullivan and Son guys for the last 3 years that saying I is bizarre. Brooklyn, Burlington, Vermont. I'm doing Higher Ground. I went to school at SUNY Plattsburgh. I went to Higher Ground a bunch of times. Saw DJ Shadow there in the late 90s. I fucking loved it. So I'm there. I am at Philadelphia. I'm at Milk Boy. I'm doing Albany, the Linda. Love Albany. Got a lot of buddies there. I'm doing Toronto, the Drake Hotel. I am doing Lancaster. I'm doing Providence, Rhode Island, the Comedy Connection. I'm doing a weekend there. It used to be a bank. It's wicked cool. And then that's going to wrap it up. I think I might have one or two other ones that I'm forgetting right now. I probably am. But it is going to be super fun. Portland, Maine. Portland, Maine I'm doing. I had to look up what ME meant because I thought Portland was Oregon. And I'm like, how the hell am I going to get to Oregon? And then I found out ME meant Maine. And I can't wait to go to Maine because I love Maine. All right, you guys. Great chat.
Yeah, and there's ample evidence except in the American press, because American writers tend to have this framework through which they see everything. But the Arab Spring, 2011, with Morocco and Egypt and all this, most of that was fueled by upper middle class people who got their law degrees, who got everything else, and the system wasn't working.
Right.
So they went after the dictator that ran the country.
Well, our forefathers were rich.
Of course. Of course.
It's typically the scariest revolutions are the ones when it's poor, but that's pretty rare.
Yes.
I mean, the peasant revolutions after Martin Luther were like that. They were poor people, and they found out Jesus was poor. Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
That was like right out of the Hunger Games.
Most revolutions are led by intellectuals.
You think that's why they're scared of intellectuals?
It almost has to be. Well, yeah. Because if you're poor, you've got to work 8-10 hours a day. But if I'm an intellectual, I could take off a Thursday and write like Marx did and Trotsky and all those folks. I can write out the manifestos, the Huron resolutions, all these things, Students for a Democratic Society, and all those things when I was young. But they were all written by people who had the leisure and the intelligence and the education to be able to write like that.
Because there's money rich and then there's time rich. And I always felt that growing up, we were time loaded because even when we were working and you were working, we were still discussing ideas or reading or, you know, I could sit on your lap while you were grading papers and we could talk about communication. You were time rich.
Yeah.
There's billionaires in this country that are not time rich. They're time poor.
Yeah.
The poor and the business leaders or the rich leaders are the ones with no time, so they don't start revolutions. It's people with that are time rich. Mm-hmm. So that's trust-funded kids or intellectuals or comedians.
Yeah.
I'm time rich as fuck.
Sure.
I mean, I put in 100-hour weeks. You know, when I'm on a show or touring, if you consider travel or writing, but you can't stay in sixth gear that long. I'm sure you face this sometimes too. And it's like, John, how many hours did you have to work this week? 20? And you're like, no, that's how much I'm on stage is basically like you're on in your own stage. But it's like, you can't stay on that level. Like you can't do a 10-hour day on stage.
No.
It's the same with like when I was a heckler, I would do that. I would do 9 hours in a stock. I mean, it's almost like it'll give you post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're putting it, you can do 10-hour, 12-hour days as a banker. But not as a writer. You can't just make your brain write for 12 hours. You have to go do something and then come back and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still like living in the world and you have this time that you can put to this. And I think the fact we were financially poor but time rich was just such an interesting combination to make a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had that like rough type, the rough exterior that could allow me to handle hecklers and relate to people's problems because we didn't have any money growing up. But at the same time, I had these like, what's a good word for it? Entitlement, but entitlement carries a bad connotation. Mm-hmm. Entitlement is it kind of like you have a right to be yourself.
Yeah. You're born to the purple. You know, people should just bow down to you.
I don't mean blue blood entitlement. I mean like entitlement as if, of course you should be able to have dinner with the president. If he likes you, great. If not, fuck him. Like that level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we had. So any other final thoughts before, because I got to go perform.
No final thoughts other than thank you for asking me to talk about something I really like to talk about.
And we're talking about your career and how in the future you may want to do more conflict resolution. I hope that becomes more of a thing. Maybe we can do a segment every now and then where you talk about conflict resolution, because I think when you hire lawyers, there's a place for lawyers. I'm friends with a lot of lawyers, but when they have a horse in the race, just know that it's not going to be a fair shot. It's the same problem with lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when someone buys a politician, they're no longer for the people. So if you could start some sort of conflict resolution company or firm or something, or just work freelance, it's like to have someone just listen to two sides and help them see the interest versus position would be very beneficial. And I hope that down the line you can do more of that stuff.
Thank you. I hope so too.
All right. Love, Pops.
Bravo.
On Monday, Josh Leibarger made his status
case of the Mondays,
followed by a frowny face. It got one like and five comments, including dislike. Well, Josh, Geico also wants to make a comment to turn that emoji's frown upside down. In just 15 minutes, you could save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance by switching to Geico. With all that extra dough, why not give Monday a makeover? We see an office party in your future, hosted by you. Hashtag happy face. Hashtag savings.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.